What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Tinakwe, no mai hare mai ki te Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Ko Egi Toku Ingoa. I'm your host, Egi Tupong, and our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, known as Melbourne. While coming up on the show, there's reports of a motion of no confidence being planned against Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, concerns of an oil leak from an old World War II shipwreck off the coast of Chook Lagoon, and Fiji may be following Australia's ban of social media for under 16-year-olds. All that and more, but I say ngā mihi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We start in Solomon Islands, where the country's main newspaper, the Solomon Star, is reporting that a motion of no confidence is being planned against Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele. Now, at the centre of the move is the controversy engulfing the government over what are known as sufferance wharves. What are sufferance wharves and why are they so politically charged? Well, joining us this morning to explore the controversy is Ofani Ereme, editor of In Depth Solomons, an online investigative organisation. With that, I say good fellow morning, Ofani.
Good fellow morning, Agi. Nice to hear from you and good to be on the programme.
Well, yes, thank you very much for your time. I do want to start off. What are sufferance wharves and why are they so important to the government?
Sufferance wharf is basically a wharf. It's a site that's commonly used to offload and upload, international cargo. It's been here for many, many years, but it recently became controversial following a number of events that we've witnessed, been reported in the Solomon Islands and regional media. Now, just to get us put us into context here, these wharves, these sufferance wharves were mostly, built by logging companies and some mining companies that been operating here. They own portions of land along the western and eastern coast of Honiara, and they build these wharves to facilitate the movement, their activities, their local activities around the country. Some of these most of these logging companies, they own boats, they own ships, they own tugboats that they used to do their business. Now, basically sufferance wharves, in order for them to use it to unload the international cargo or do the export, they have to first of all get a permit from customs, from the controller of customs. And that's the only way you could, be allowed to use those wharves. Eh? So even if a company owns a wharf, a sovereign's wharf, they cannot just use it unless they get a permission. They have to apply to get a permission from the controller of customs. So that's how it works. Now, recently, as you might be aware from the news, Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, made a reshuffle. He removed his finance minister, Harry Kumar, and placed him at the Minister of Commerce. In exchange, he moved the Minister for Commerce over to the Finance Ministry. Now, he at the time, Chairman Manele was basically saying that this is a normal government procedure. So he was basically trying to, make the government more effective in its delivery of its services to the people, and that reshuffling exercise was part of making things more functional, more work better within this government. But later on, it came out, it emerged from what we have found out that Hari Kumar was actually, moved or removed from the Ministry of Finance because he issued directives for all these sovereign's wharves. And we are talking about around 6-7 wharves that were built along the coastlines on both sides of Honiara. So he made an instruction, he made an order that there will be no use of wharves. They will be temporarily suspended while a committee, that has been established by the government some months back, look at the use of the sovereign's wharves. Now, what happened was that, after Hari Kumar made the decision, he was removed. And the moment the new Minister of Finance, Trevor Manamahige, came in, he basically sort of removed the instruction, the order that Hari Kumar made earlier. So that's how this issue became news lately and was very highly controversial as a result of what we have witnessed lately.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that, Ofani. Yeah, and so I do understand, obviously, the controversy now around those sufferant wharves in Solomon Islands. I'm just wondering then, do you expect that there will be some sort of political resolution soon, or is this controversy headed for debate in Parliament around these sufferant wharves?
The new finance minister, Trevor, made an announcement recently that now that he restored the use and the operations of these wharves, there is a committee, there's a cabinet committee that's been established to look into the issue. That particular committee is expected to sort of produce a report by the end of October. That's when we'll hear more from the Minister of Finance on whether these sovereign's wharves will continue to be used or will be banned from being used in the future. Now, definitely this issue will be subject to heavy debate, heavy questioning when Parliament next meet. So, yeah, it's been, the opposition has been talking about lately that they've accused the government of being biased towards these sovereign's wharf operators. Opposition leader Madiwale believes that the decision that the former finance minister Hari Kumar made should stand while this cabinet committee does its work. He felt that, there should be a policy put in place surrounding how these sovereign's wharves should be operated. So basically, it's going to be heavily debated, heavily it will be a subject of heavy questioning from the opposition, I believe, when Parliament next meets. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, funny. Look, I apologise. That is all the time that we have for this morning. But thank you so much for keeping us across this. We definitely will keep our eyes and ears out on the development of this situation. Thank you again.
Thank you, Abby. Thank you.
And that there is Ofani Edeme. He's the editor for In Depth Solomon with In Depth Solomon here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, leaders in the Federated States of Micronesia say toxic oil leaking from a World War II shipwreck may just be the tip of the iceberg of what is to come over the coming years. The leaking Japanese vessel, the Rio de Janeiro Maru, is one of 64 shipwrecks in shallow waters off the coast of Chuuk Lagoon. And according to Peter Tin, Division Chief of Commerce and Industry in the state of Chuuk, they contain somewhere between 600 and 1,500 tonnes of oil, which could be about to burst to the surface.
Well, to put it in perspective, and thanks to your government of Australia, they help us do a study. They just finished up and they reported back, and the ambassador just submitted the report last April. And that report stated that within 5 to 10 years, there will be oil leakage. So that was last April. It's 5 months. I do not know if you call it escalated, but they did determine within 5 years. So,
yeah, so yes. The timeline you were given was 5 years, but within 5 months we have an oil spill from an old Japanese vessel, which your leader spoke about at the UN General Assembly.
Yes, Rio General is the name of the ship. It's a Japanese auxiliary transport. It's east of one of our islands called Uman.
And how was the leak discovered? Was it discovered by, like, local fishermen, or was it local villagers who, you know, saw a discoloration in the water?
Both, because it's very close to the island, so the locals found oil seepage and also a dive ship that does operations over here. What they have informed us is that it looks like the pressure was just too much. Our dive experts over here are also thinking of other things that might have happened, like change in weather and all that. So they were not able to get in there because it's too risky. We don't want them to take a chance.
And this particular vessel, is it relatively shallow?
Yes, it's within 40 feet.
And what impact has this had on the local population? Like, has a food source been contaminated? Has it impacted local fishermen?
Currently, we are telling the locals to stay away from the water. The oil has reached inland, has affected the mangrove and like that. Of course, it's dark, it's black. At the beginning of the oil leakage, it was up to 4 inches. It affected the docks and everything on there, the sea life.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the four affected villages don't have deep well. They're using rainwater. So there is no contamination of their local water. But they have been reported cases of dizziness and all like that due to the fumes and the smell of the oil.
That's good news that there's no contamination to the local water sources, but that's not to say that there might not be down the track. So what can be done to fix the issue? I mean, you've obviously raised the matter at the UN General Assembly.
Well, we have sent and requested our partners from US, Japan, even Australia for assistance in whatever we can. We do have damping mats that suck up the oil whenever we put the mats down and like that. And that's what we're currently using to clean up. We're also using detergents, soap and all like that to also help clean up.
Yeah, but I guess that's probably only a temporary solution at the moment, isn't it? Because there would be so much oil, I imagine, in that ship.
Well, I'll give you a perspective of how much oil. The Australian study showed that it's between 600 to 1,500 tons of oil left.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Looking beyond that, you know, this is just one ship. I mean, there's a number of ships that currently lie on the bottom of the seafloor in those shallow waters around Chook Lagoon. Looking ahead, do you hold fears that these other ships might also start to deteriorate at a rapid rate?
That is very obvious. This is just the beginning. We have officially 63 shipwrecks in the lagoon. So this will be the first one that is leaking out. And if this Australian study showed, they did a study on 20 of the shipwrecks. And their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil still in our waters. So that would be a very big devastation if one or two or all of them start leaking out at the same time.
It's an unfathomable amount, really.
And that is Peter Tin, Division Chief of Commerce and Industry in the state of Chook, and he was speaking with Carl Evans. Now stay tuned for your news wrap. It's coming up shortly, along with the latest on online safety in Fiji here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or where you get your podcasts.
Me taki maata, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, at least one country in the Pacific will be watching very closely when Australia bans social media access to under-16s in December. The move is aimed at protecting children from online harm and promoting healthy development. Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister Manoa Kamikamita says the Australian experience will determine if Fiji takes on similar restrictions.
Honourable Speaker, we are closely following the Australian ban on social media use for children under the age of 16. Currently, most platforms require users to be 13. We acknowledge that having this implemented properly could be another effective layer in safeguarding our children from inappropriate content. At the same time, we recognise the significant challenges which include technology required to accurately verify a user's age and its use on our children, and legal frameworks including regulatory measures for non-compliance, amongst others. Australia's law requiring service providers not to register or maintain accounts of the users under 16 begins in December, and a study mission to Australia tentatively next year will help us understand the framework before considering its application in Fiji.
And that there is Manoa Kamikamita, Deputy Prime Minister, speaking in Fiji's Parliament. Kia ora, welcome back to Pacific Beat. We are now heading around the region to get your latest headlines, and that's always brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, joining me in the studio this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Hugh Aggie. I am well. Happy hump day.
Yes, absolutely. The middle of the week. A couple of stories from the region. We start off with Samoa's new leader, Tuimalialii Whanau Va'aletoa Etsisualauvi, has declared a state of emergency over a budget crisis. What's happened here?
Yes, budgets and finance. It's going to be a bit of a theme in today's news wrap, but a 30-day state of emergency has been imposed in Samoa due to a financial crisis triggered by the failure to pass the budget earlier in the year. So this is what's known as an appropriation bill, and it's basically what authorises the government to spend money. However, because they failed to pass that budget, the PM has had to trigger the SOE under the clause of the Constitution, which effectively gives the government access to funds from the Treasury just to ensure that government operations can continue. Now, as for why they've run out of money, the government's Savali newspaper is saying that it's due to the inability to pass the budget earlier in the year. That's what triggered the election. Therefore, the government had to enter caretaker mode. That meant the country could only operate on 25% of the budget for the next financial year, which obviously isn't enough. So now that this 30-day emergency is in place, the government can now work on that main budget for the next financial year, which I'm sure they're going to want to get done as soon as possible, Aggie.
And I also believe, meanwhile, a similar thing is happening or unfolding in Palau.
Yeah, that's right. It's seemed to have taken a lot of media publications by surprise, but according to the Island Times, Palau is on track for a shutdown today amid a budget standoff between Palau's two legislative chambers. Wow. They've published a letter from the president himself, Srangawips Jr., saying that as of October 1, which is obviously today, the fiscal year has ended and a national budget for 2026 has yet to be passed. That means the government can't legally spend money. So they are in a wait-and-see mode now as well. The government will next convene on October 10. Right. In the meantime, there'll be no new hires, no new contracts or payments made, and no salary payments until a new budget is enacted. So, yeah, I'm sure there'll be some very angry public servants in Palau at the moment.
Okay, well, let's head on to Vanuatu now, who might have some financial issues of their own, but for different reasons. What are those reasons?
Yes, very different reasons indeed. So there's some serious concerns about the possible misuse of government property after 250 chainsaws worth 12 million vatu were handed out without proper procedure. So these were chainsaws that were given to the government as part of its recovery program after they were hit by two major cyclones. They were meant to go to places like schools to help clear debris, to reopen roads and to support emergency services. However, schools and services say they never received them, even though official records show that 250 were distributed. And it gets a little bit worse as well. A leaked internal list that was actually published by the Vanuatu Daily Post showed where they supposedly were supposed to end up. And many of the people on that list actually have no connection to schools or any sort of disaster work recovery efforts. That's led to claims that the chainsaws may have been given out as potential political gifts or favours.
Right.
So, not great sense. News there.
Yeah, no, unfortunately. But let's go on to some good news. To sport now, and in rugby league, the Fiji Butty, they've been given a big boost.
Yeah, the Fainu brothers, Samuela and Sione, who both play for the West Tigers, my team actually, in the NRL, nice. They've elected to play for the Butty at the Pacific Championships. Both were eligible to play for Tonga, but have elected to play for Fiji. And their third brother, Latu, may actually join them as well come the World Cup, but he'll be injured for the Pacific Games. For the Pacific Championships, unfortunately. So, yeah, look, Fiji looking pretty stacked. All of a sudden, five West Tigers players in the team, along with Jareem Buller and Sunia Taruva, who I've always rated as a very, very good player.
Nice.
However, they will be at Api Korosia, who's in a lot of ways their spiritual barometer. Also captain of the West Tigers, I should point out. Look, they're looking very well placed for their first game against the Cook Islands on October 18, which, as it turns out, Aggie will be broadcast right here on ABC Radio Australia.
Yeah, so stay tuned for that. But look, we're finishing up. I think we've got some sporting history for New Caledonia at the FIFA Under-20 Men's World Cup in Chile.
Yes, so the team from the French Pacific Territory didn't win their first ever game on the global stage. Far from it, in fact. They did lose 9-1 to the USA, but after trailing 7-0 at halftime, the young Cougar restricted the Americans to just two more goals after the break and then produced the biggest cheer of the night in the 70th minute. So let's take a listen.
Rare touch for the USA goalkeeper. Oh, it's a gift! New Caledonia score, and just listen to the noise. Adam Beaudry providing a tap in for Wape Simani, who makes history for his nation as the first ever New Caledonia goal scorer at an Under-20 World Cup.
Yeah, look, a truly great moment for the young New Caledonian player on the world stage. Mm. And next up for him and his team will be a game against South Africa on Friday, to be followed by what promises to be a feisty clash next Monday against France. So stay tuned for that one.
Look forward to that. As always, Vina Kakao for bringing our news wrap. Pacific Beat. The battle to host next year's United Nations climate talks is very much undecided, as we've been reporting on Pacific Beat. Australia, backed by Pacific countries, has put its hands up to host, but Turkey is also claiming its right to COP31. It's a diplomatically tricky situation, but one innovative solution being touted is for both countries to share hosting rights. So for more on this story, we are joined by ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts. With that, I say good morning, Stephen. Hello there, Stephen. Hey, look, thank you for joining us this morning. I want to say, before we even figure out how this would look, how did we even get to this situation?
Yeah, well, I think Australia has been expecting for a while that Turkey would simply withdraw from this contest. This has been going on for quite some time. And because Australia has, and people have confirmed this outside, you know, the Australian government, pretty broad support from within the group whose turn it is to host. That's called the Western European and Others group. It's basically a sort of ungainly mechanism that COP has got to try and make sure everyone has a turn to put their hand up for the gig. So because Australia's been in a very strong position and has got a lot of private and public expressions of support for its bid, most people seem to simply assume, at least in Canberra, that at some point Turkey would gracefully withdraw from the contest and acknowledge that Australia had broader support. But that simply has not happened. Mm. Turkey has stuck in the ring. It's continued to insist that it's got a level of support for its bid, that it's its turn to bid. It feels like it made a decision to withdraw back from the COP 25 on Glasgow, and that it's therefore its turn. Because the way this is structured and the way the UNFCCC rules work, there's no real mechanism to break the deadlock. You can't force a vote within the Western Europe and Others group. You simply have to reach a so-called gentleman's agreement. And because Turkey has been unwilling to withdraw gracefully, we've been stuck in this situation with what is basically a deadlock, a diplomatic impasse. Mm. And if there's no resolution, what's sort of meant to happen, although there are a few different theories around about this, is that it will just revert back to the UNFCCC headquarters in the city of Bonn in Germany. And that's something, obviously, that Australia doesn't want to see. That the Pacific certainly wouldn't want to see, that Germany, I gather, doesn't really want to see, and which Turkey wouldn't want to see either.
Okay. Well, Stephen, as you said, if Turkey does not gracefully withdraw, we are now looking at this possibility of sharing hosting rights, right? So how would it practically work then in Australia and Turkey?
Well, look, the first thing to say is that there's no resolution on this. And this is an idea that has been floated, but it has not yet been accepted by Turkey or by Australia or, in fact, by the Pacific. So this is one of the ideas that is absolutely in the mix. And some people in the Pacific say it's the most likely way this will be resolved. But we've got no certainty that this is the way forward. It's just a very interesting idea that's been put forward as a possible resolution. It's not entirely clear how it would work, but it isn't an entirely unprecedented suggestion. We have seen split COPs before where one country retains the presidency. That's not something that could be split, but where another country plays a role in hosting other COP events. That was seen, for example, when the United Kingdom had the presidency and hosted the main event in Glasgow. There was a pre-COP meeting that was held in Italy, in Milan, for example. So it's possible something like that could work this time around, or perhaps something a bit more substantive, where Turkey isn't given the presidency but does agree to host a series of other events, perhaps an event of climate ministers, for example, either before or even after the main event in Australia. The most important thing here, though, to stress is that Turkey came to Australia with this idea of splitting the presidency, in other words, really splitting the event in half and both hosting events whilst holding the presidency. The difficulty there is that UNFCCC has made it very clear that the rules don't allow for a presidency. One country, in the end, has to hold the presidency, and the president has to be one person. from that country. So, yes, this is a possible way forward, definitely, but in the end, Turkey will still have to agree that Australia holds the presidency.
All right. And has there been sort of a reaction from Pacific nations about this possibility with Australia and Turkey sharing hosting rights?
Yeah, there has been some discussion about this. Australia, unsurprisingly, has been very keen to loop in Pacific nations about what's being contemplated. There was a briefing, I'm told, last week, in New York, when the Prime Minister was there. A number of Pacific officials and leaders were basically looped in. And there's another meeting coming up in the next couple of days, particularly on Friday in Sydney, with Chris Bowen, the Energy and Climate Minister, and Pacific Climate Ministers. So they're doing a series of events, but I imagine they'll also have a sit down in Sydney, and I think this will be very much at the top of the agenda. So Australia will try and get sort of official, I suspect, Pacific support for the notion. I've spoken to a couple of people in the Pacific about the idea within Pacific governments. And it's a bit of a mixed reaction. One Pacific Island source I spoke to said that they thought it was probably the only way forward. They weren't sort of necessarily hugely enthusiastic about the idea, but they did say that that they understood, you know, the difficult situation Australia was in, and said, yes, there was a need for an innovative solution to try and break the deadlock. Another Pacific Island source I spoke to was a little bit more lukewarm on it. They were worried that if Turkey had shared hosting rights with Australia, that would further dilute the Pacific Islands' influence over the event and make it harder to drive for international action. So we'll have to wait and see, you know, where this idea lands and whether the Pacific supports it. It is worth noting, just briefly, Aggie, that the idea of a co-presidency was actually raised earlier this year, I think around April or so, by some Pacific nations, by them saying, well, why don't we have the co-presidency with you? Why don't we share the presidency in the same way that Turkey has proposed that? But Australia's response, I gather, to Pacific nations back then was the same as it is to Turkey right now, which is, sorry, it's just not possible. We've checked with the UNFCCC and they say it's not possible within the rules. So the Pacific, it will have to, if it does go on board with this, I think it will still push for a role in this, perhaps, you know, hosting, for example, some ministers between PIF and the COP in Adelaide, assuming it happens there. Maybe hosting a pre-COP, you know, in somewhere like Brisbane and then taking delegates to Pacific nations. But, you know, there's still an awful lot of fluidity around this.
But I do have to ask, though, Stephen, look, the possibility, as you say, if it does happen, this arrangement, do we know an expected time frame as to when it will happen?
Well, they'll have to make a decision one way or the other before late November, which is when COP30 wraps up in the city of Belém in Brazil, in the Amazon. The rules, as best as we can decipher and discern, are basically that if there's no resolution by the end of that COP, then it seems to have to revert to Bonn. So that's the deadline, if you like. Only really, gosh, around 7 or 8 weeks from now, 7 weeks from now. So that's the amount of time that Australia has, I guess, to reach this resolution. But doing that will require an agreement primarily with Turkey, but also, of course, with Pacific Island nations. There's some suggestion it could come before Belém. One source I spoke to said that the hope was that they get Pacific sign off, you know, this week and next, and then shortly after that, they get an agreement from Turkey. But of course, it's entirely possible Turkey holds out even longer, and that we don't get a resolution, if at all, until Belém in mid to late November. That's the time frame we're playing with, but it's simply not clear when this is actually going to happen.
Well, we appreciate you, Stephen, you know, keeping across this story, and I know you will be updating us. So appreciate you coming on the show this morning.
No problem. Thanks, Aggie.
And that is our ABC Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jettitz, here on Pacific Beat. Now, look, a quick recap of our story so far. Reports of a motion of no confidence was planned against Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele. Also concerns of an oil leak from an old World War II shipwreck off the coast of Chuuk Lagoon. And Fiji may be following Australia's ban of social media for under 16-year-olds. But still to come, landmine detectors used in Ukraine may be of benefit to locating unexploded ordnance provinces in Solomon Islands. And you may have heard of Driving Miss Daisy, but what about Driving Three Kings? It's a memoir of a bond between Australia and Tonga. All of that here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yandra, and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a landmine detector invented in Australia is soon to be used in war-ravaged Ukraine, but it may also have a big role to play in the Pacific. The new technology is the result of a partnership between the National Science Agency, the CSIRO, and a private company. As Julia Bergen reports, the developers say the device is revolutionary because it detects explosives rather than metal. And that could prove to be an important difference when it comes to locating the unexploded ordnances from World War II that still litters countries like Solomon Islands.
Until now, finding landmines has involved a metal detector and a lot of guesswork.
The metal detector goes off and says there's something metallic here.
John Shanahan is speaking to us from the outskirts of Kyiv in Ukraine, where he's in a car travelling to a landmine site.
The depth could be anything from laid on the surface to about 15 centimetres below surface. And so just short of where they think the mine is, whether it's pouring rain or boiling hot, they will then start digging down by hand.
John Shanahan heads up a company called MREED, which specialises in landmine removal technology. He says the problem with traditional detectors is they pick up anything that's metal. For every one landmine they find, they also detect 134 pieces of metal rubbish. And for every one of those false positives, a human has to dig by hand to investigate. Each dig takes 30 to 40 minutes, so it becomes extremely time-consuming.
It could be just bits of old blown-up vehicles. It could be knives, it could be different type of metallic soil. It's just rubbish. It's just nothing explosive there at all. But they have to dig down and treat it as an explosive until they have evidence to prove that it's not.
Ukraine has the highest concentration of landmines in the world, and it's the only country where demining is happening while a war is still raging. The minefields John Shanahan is heading to were, not long ago, the front lines of Russia's assault. He's there to meet a team of workers known in the sector as deminers and show them a new Australian-made landmine detector. What makes it special is that instead of simply detecting metal, this one can tell the difference between bomb and no bomb.
With the help of this detector, we will not spend time for every excavation of something suspicious, and it will speed up the process really greatly.
Dmytro Rahula is one of the Ukrainian deminers John Shanahan meets.
Every mine that we remove could save someone's life.
Back in Australia, I met with three of John Shanahan's colleagues to learn more. In a small room at the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation at Lucas Heads on Sydney's Southern Fringe, a former CSIRO scientist, an electronics engineer, and a physicist are packed between robotic drivers, 3D printers, various other gadgets, and a whiteboard covered in diagrams and notes.
What you do is you load components on these things on the side here, and this robot picks up the components, places them on the board down to sub-millimeter precision, and then they're soldered into place.
That's the other half of MREED, former CSIRO scientist Nick Cutmore. Put simply, they've invented a device that detects the explosive element in landmines.
Mine detected.
What this thing is doing when you press that button is it's sending out a signal every 7 milliseconds down there, and it sends a radio wave into the ground. Then it turns the signal off and listens for what comes back, accumulates the signal, and then starts all over again. And we add all these things together over seconds to create hundreds and hundreds of analyses, and that gives us enough statistics to say there is a mine here or there isn't a mine here.
The new device looks like a metal detector. It's just shy of 2 metres long. It's got a long shaft with a box of electronics at the top end and what looks like a white lampshade at the bottom. That's the sensor.
The way that this works in the field is the operator holds this, puts their arm through the holding point, holds on to the pistol grip here like a crutch, and then holds this over the ground where we're trying to detect in a minefield.
This is an old prototype, the one the team has already tested in Angola and Cambodia. It weighs about 10 kilograms. The new version will be half that for their next big project in Ukraine. That's why John Shanahan's in the country and why Nick Cutmore and his colleagues are working round the clock to make the device smaller and faster.
You can actually see it here. So this is the old system. All of that, lots of rat's nest of cables, and we're trying to shrink it down to about this size. Yeah,
that's the size.
Okay, so it's, what, like a third? Even
probably
more?
Well, actually, probably more like 80% shrink. So it's a huge task to shrink that. Someone eventually, right, is carrying it into a minefield. The minefield is partly cleared of vegetation. It's often semi-jungle. It's filled with all sorts of hazards as well as the mines. And so you need to create technology which is light enough to carry, to use all day in 35 degrees heat, carry it around, hold it in place, detect mines, go about their work for the whole day and do that smoothly. If we implement our technology as we plan, we could speed global demining by at least 30%.
And that there is Nick Cutmore from tech company MREED, ending that report from Julia Burgeon.
This is Pacific Beat.
Well, for more than 50 years, the Waterhouse family has proudly served the Tongan royal family. And that connection began in the 1940s when Bill Waterhouse became friends with a young Crown Prince Te Pōtoa while studying law at Sydney University. Now, in her memoirs, Driving Three Kings, daughter of Bill, Louise Waterhouse, shares personal stories with Tonga, including the honour of driving for three kings. And it highlights Tonga's enduring relationship with Australia. So joining us this morning is the author herself, Louise Waterhouse, who also serves as the Honorary Consul General for the Kingdom of Tonga in Australia. With that, I say malo lele and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Aggie. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Look, firstly, congratulations on the release of your book. But Louise, now your father, Bill Waterhouse, he befriended the Crown Prince Te Pōtoa. Can you sort of tell us how special was that friendship?
Well, it was quite extraordinary because there were opposites attracting, and because you had His Majesty, or who was then the Crown Prince, as the reserved, quiet, studious type, and my father, who was a bit of a boy about town. So I think it was a bit like the magnet. They appealed to each other. And so when it was quite a wonderful relationship that endured for all those years. And in fact, my father regarded His Late Majesty as his best friend in the world. And I think it might have been reciprocated.
Wow. And you know, when you look back at that connection, how do you feel like it's influenced maybe your understanding of Tonga itself, its culture and its values?
Well, I think, you know, I understand, and that's why I've written this book, is to share with the world the very, very special nature of what Tonga is all about. Tonga is different to anywhere else, and the culture, the people. And I always say, you know, we in Australia can learn so much from Tongan culture, from Tongan values, how they treat each other, how they treat their elderly, how they go about their daily lives. Tonga is an amazing role model, I think, for the rest of the world.
So, Louise, you know, when we look at your memoir, Driving Three Kings, I mean, look, it includes His Majesty King Taufa, you know, Ahau Te Pō the IV, then we have King George Te Pō the V, and now the current king, King Te Pō the VI. Describe what that experience was like for you and your family, having to drive the three kings.
Well, that's been a bit of a fun side of things because over the years, of course, you know, being around such a long time and organising so many things, I've had the opportunity and the privilege to be able to drive all three kings. And it reflects also the trust and the personal relationship that they allowed me to transport their king. But there's also a little bit of a thought in there about we've done our bit to try and help drive the kingdom. And over these 50 years, we have seen the kingdom grow into an extraordinary nation. It's always been a fabulous country, but just grow from strength to strength. And that's what really is so fulfilling, just a wonderful thing to have seen. And that's why I was inspired. In fact, it was our High Commissioner in Canberra, Curtis Kui Hangalangi, that said to me, Louise, you need to write this down. And I said, oh, well, I could do a booklet perhaps. But once I started, Aggie, I couldn't stop. The words just kept flowing because it was such a joy to go back and remember all these extraordinary experiences and also to celebrate the wonderful things that Tonga has done. Anecdotes like the mouse that roared, where Tonga was the first country, sovereign nation, to apply for 15 satellite spots up in the sky when New Zealand forgot to apply for any and Australia, I think, applied for two. So there are lots of ways that Tonga actually was punching well above its weight and has continued to do so over the years.
Yeah. One thing, though, most people would know that the royal family is quite private, right? But was there any point where you were sort of hesitant to share this memoir so publicly? Like what made you decide now was the right time to share these stories?
Well, this is the 50 years. It's quite an extraordinary thing, and I don't think it's been replicated anywhere in the world that one family has looked after a country on an honorary basis for 50 years. And so that's what His Excellency said to me, "Look, Louise, if you don't write this down, it'll be lost to history." And I think this is because I've had a very special and privileged role, seeing things from the inside and from the outside, from all sorts of perspectives, I do think it's been very worthwhile to write down. And whilst I say in the book, you know, what's said in the car stays in the car, mm-hmm. I have shared lots of personal insights. And I'm sure that their majesties and their late majesties would be very happy with those, because it shows what wonderful people they are, what kind and caring people they are, how their whole motivation is how to help their people. Mm. And that's what really moves me. And as I say in the book, Aggie, that it all started with Tupou the First. He was an extraordinary man at six generations ago. And when he came to Australia in 1853, and he was dismayed to see so many homeless people starving on the streets. And he said, "What is it? Why isn't your queen looking after her people?" And I think that summarizes exactly the attitude of the Tongan royal family. They realize that they have to look after their people. And it's that paternal and maternal approach that sets them apart.
Wow. If you've just joined, I'm speaking to author Louise Waterhouse on her latest book, Driving Three Kings, a memoir of her personal relationship with the Tongan royal family and, of course, the bonds between Australia and Tonga. Louise, your book also, going through some notes, you also highlight the Francis Greenway program. What is that about?
Well, the thing is, you know, obviously I've been around a long time and I've seen the highs and the lows, and there have been wonderful, wonderful things with the relationship with Australia. But there is a thorn in the side, and I call it the elephant in the room, and that is that Australia and New Zealand and America, they have this very politically popular program of deporting criminals once they've served their sentence to their national or their home of their nationhood. We in Tonga are really badly affected, because Tongan people love to keep their passports and their nationality because they're so proud. Mm. And as a result, Tonga is a country of 100,000 people, now has over 1,000 criminal deportees. And I've sadly seen this over the years, Aggie, that Tonga's culture and society has been changed and undermined by the importation of people that don't want to be there, and they don't really have a role in Tonga. They don't necessarily speak the language, and they've just, you know, they've eroded Tongan culture, and it's really a short-term expediency is a really sad situation. So I've come up with this idea of saying, well, look, okay, we think about Australia. We're a land of forgiveness. We're a colony that was founded with convicts, and we made a go of it by giving these people a second chance. So perhaps what we need to do is to identify people that are going to be deported eventually. And they don't have to do anything very bad, you know. They could be in a fight in a pub and get sentenced to a jail for a year, and that means they're on the deportation highway. But if we could give them skills that they could use back in Tonga, teach them to be painters or builders or IT or something along those lines, and then teach them the culture, because a lot of them don't understand Tongan culture, and then also perhaps give them a chance to apply for a small grant, a few thousand dollars that would get them to start a new life, because at the moment, when they go back, they have no hope, and they're outcasts over there. They don't want to be there, and they're undermining society. And as I disclose in the book, you know, it was actually deportees that started the riots or caused the riots in 2006, which destroyed 80% of Nukualofa's CBD. Mm. And that was that terrible slippery slope that then, to rebuild Tonga, you know, that Tonga had to go and take the big loan with China, which we're now still suffering from, because the loan still has to be repaid. So it has far-reaching consequences rather than short-term expediency. So whilst I'm vehemently opposed to this program, at least I think you know, if we insist as the West in doing this, we need to do something that those people going back can become good citizens and perhaps reverse the brain drain.
Yeah.
Do something positive.
Yeah, and look, from listening to you, there sounds like there's quite a few highs and lows in this book. What then do you most hope readers will take away from this book?
Well, I love people to, both Tongan people, to understand and be proud of their culture, because I see a lot of, especially young generations, they don't understand just what Tonga stands for. And also for the Westerns, the Palangi, for like me, to appreciate Tongan culture and realize there are lessons we can learn from the way they live their lives. And one of the things that Australia's benefited from is this seasonal worker program, where we've got Tongan workers coming over and they work harder than anyone else. You know, there's not island time for those Tongan workers. And also carers, aid carers, you know, there's that disability, aged care, doing such an amazing job because they have this wonderful work ethic and caring for each other, something we all can learn.
Absolutely. Look, we literally have just 1 minute left, Louise, but I'm wondering, will this book or the relationship that you've had with Tonga impact maybe on broader ties between Tonga and Australia?
Well, I hope so. And in fact, while their Majesties were here, there was a historic statement of intent signed by called Komea Hofi, meaning friends, deep friendship. And that's what I'm hoping, that this special trip that was to Australia to commemorate our 50th anniversary will lead to bigger and greater things and a better understanding of how Tonga can help Australia and Australia can help Tonga.
Beautiful. Louise, I wish we had a lot more time to speak, but it's wonderful to hear, you know, your thoughts on just how you honour my beautiful homeland of Tonga. So thank you very much for joining us this morning.
You should be very proud, Aggie. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That is Louise Waterhouse, author of Driving Three Kings and Honorary Consul General for the Kingdom of Tonga in Australia. And that literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Recapping our top story, leaders in the Federated States of Micronesia say toxic oil leaking from a World War II shipwreck may just be the tip of the iceberg of what is to come over the coming years.
We have officially 63 shipwrecks in the lagoon. They did a study on 20 of the shipwrecks. And their estimate is from 3.5 to 6 million gallons of oil still in our waters.
And that's Peter Atten, a Division Chief of Commerce and Industry in the state of Chuuk. Find those stories when you type in Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. Let's do it again, same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can tune in this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next is your news, and coming up after that, it's Nija Daily. Until next time, o tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat.